Support for this podcast comes from the UTSA Institute of Texan Cultures, hosting the Asian Festival, 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. February 1st. It's a day of hands-on activities for kids and families with music, dance, martial arts demonstrations, food vendors preparing authentic Asian dishes, a gallery of bonsai trees, and other attractions. Details and ticket info at asianfestivalsa.com.
Welcome to Fronteras, a program about issues along the U.S.-Mexico border and changing demographics in the Southwest. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. If you do a Google search of queer Texas history, a Wikipedia page starts a timeline at 1975. Certainly, large strides have been made for LGBTQ rights since then, including the overturning of the Texas sodomy law and all U.S. sodomy laws in 2003, and the 2013 Supreme Court decision that gave same-sex couples the right to marry. These victories are piled on the backs of the small triumphs and failures of decades past. Gene Alviar is a recent graduate of the University of Texas at San Antonio. He pursued a field of research that uncovered Texas history that remained in the shadows in the early 20th century. Alviar explains his start on this incredibly personal project.
It was during my seminar in history course that I was tasked with presenting an original research paper that's, you know, some 25 pages long. I had no idea what I was going to do. All I knew that the subject was the American West. That's daunting. That's a huge epoch of time. And so I ended up focusing down on Texas history, and then I focused it further down onto Texas queer history. And that came about because of my personal experiences as a gay man in Texas. I realized that there was not much written on Texas queer history, almost at all. There's contemporary versions of it out and about where we talk about maybe within the last 20, 40 years of queer history and queer rights and movements and things like that, but there's not really anything that spans before that.
So what did you find that was kind of your aha moment? Oh, this is from before 20 years ago.
The aha moment was a picture in the LGBTQ archive online, and it was a picture. It was an old flyer, black and white, or actually it was kind of like yellowish because of how old it was, of a nightclub. It was called the Wagon Wheel Nightclub. Big bold text on the top and the bottom. And in the picture is a frame of a man dressed as a woman with extra individual performers surrounding his frame. And I saw that and I was just like, I've never seen that before. Where is this from? And then from there, the search began to find more information about this picture and exactly what this institution is and where was it? What happened to it? Where can I find more of this? And that search progressed to newspaper archives through UTSA's resources. I reached out to the Houston Public Library to see if they can find the clips that are mentioned in another online archive. They couldn't, sadly. But that's where the aha moment began, with that little picture that I found online, probably in like September when I was starting to look for things.
So what did you learn about that Wagon Wheel?
Okay, the Wagon Wheel Nightclub was a heterotopia for like gay and queer individuals.
What does that mean?
A heterotopia is just a space where individuals of the same manner can basically exist. It's kind of like another way of saying just like men's club or boys' club or girls' club, basically. So what I learned was that it was a nightclub serving that those type of individuals. And it was
located... Cross-dressers in particular, or...?
I believe so. Like I said, what I can glean from it was that it was serving queer individuals and cross-dressers alike because they were hosting those type of performances there based off of the flyers and what I could find in newspaper articles. I love that I was able to find where it was located. It was located in Houston, Texas on Airline Road back in 1936, if I remember correctly. It burned down in 1938. So it was open from 1936 to about 1938, if I remember the time correctly. And no newspaper in Houston reported about it. But a San Antonio journalist from the San Antonio Express, I think, reported on the incident. He just commented that it was an act of arson. No people were identified in the act of how this building burned down. But that was it. It was just a small, like, 2-inch by 2-inch clipping of a San Antonio Express newspaper.
Gay clubs have kind of always been around, but they've been operating in the shadows. And so it's got to be really difficult to find that kind of history because, again, it was supposed to be kept secret. And those who knew new. So how difficult was it for you to start digging up history like that of the wagon wheel?
Oh, it was incredibly difficult. Absolutely. It was a daunting task. Most of my semester doing that paper was research. I don't know how I really passed the rest of my courses, but I did. It was an excruciating process because you were looking for mentions and words that could be used to insinuate LGBTQ or queer individuals in some type of manner. Mainly, I got lucky. That's how I will say this. I got lucky because the female impersonators, what they refer to themselves as and how the public viewed them, men who dressed as women and women who dressed as men, female impersonators and male impersonators. And so I got lucky by finding that those two words, female impersonators. And from there, it led on to a plethora of just newspaper mentions, articles, different types of little mentions here and there throughout newspapers in the state. And so once I found that, it became easy. But beforehand, I was just typing in whatever I could find because I really didn't have the resources to go out to look at these newspaper articles. I was relying mainly on online databases. It wasn't an easy process, but once those keywords were found, it became a lot easier to start finding more and more and more of this. And to the point where you just start wondering, okay, there's all of this information. Why hasn't it been discussed before, in particular to Texas history? I also got lucky by the fact that female impersonators were incredibly public individuals. If you're performing on a stage in full drag, people are going to see it. And so people did see it, and some people enjoyed it, and some people did not enjoy it. And you never hear from the people who are happy. You only hear from the people who are mad is kind of what I found out in my research. And so I just kept on finding newspaper mentions of them being arrested, nightclubs being raided, being arrested on trumped-up charges and things like that. And so once I figured that out, I started looking at law. And whenever you look at the old Texas penal codes, there's a lot of ambiguity in relation to its attitude towards queer individuals. The Texas Penal Code did not have an accurate definition of the word sodomy up until 1943, is whenever they actually changed the language to remove some of the evangelical wording of the article. So once that got amended, you actually got a legal definition that these individuals could be tried under. The only issue with that is that they were still being tried under an insufficient definition. This definition does not accurately define what sodomy is or what can be attributed to sodomy. So how are these individuals being arrested? And so I started looking through cases and I was seeing that individuals were arguing against this ambiguous penal code. This means people are recognizing that this is not sufficient. You can't be arrested for something that is not legally defined. Why are they still being arrested still? That penal code definition stays all the way up until 1943, but it doesn't change. But in that epoch of time from Texas's union with the United States to 1943, there are individuals who are being arrested, individuals who are pushing back, and then individuals who are being arrested again. So what happened in that space of time where individuals were being arrested, pushed back, and then arrested again? Something happened in between that linear progression of development. Texas legislation changed.
They basically made it fuzzier so that more people could be convicted under
a particular law. Yes, exactly what they did. They chose to change it to allow for a wider and more ambiguous definition of any interpretation of the law. And that way, these individuals could be arrested under that. And so that's for homosexuality. In terms to female impersonators and their arrest record, they were being charged with vagrancy, an ambiguous statute all on its own. If you look at the definition of vagrancy back then, it encompassed individuals who were not employed, whose employment was not steady in terms of pay, whose employment did not provide any type of benefits or anything like that.
Like entertainers?
Yes, like entertainers, whose work is not steady, who work fluctuates, and who don't really stay in one place. They move all over the state. There's an article that I remember reading that is the only article that mentions race, their ethnicity. It was two African-Americans, female impersonators, who were arrested, I believe it was in Corpus Christi. They were walking down the side of the street from a gig going back home, and they were just pulled off the street and arrested and thrown into a cop car.
Were they dressed
as women? Yeah, they were in full, female impersonator dress, and so they were just arrested off of the side of the street for the charge of vagrancy. And so then you start seeing that being applied to female impersonators, and that continuing up until vagrancy gets a little bit more defined.
They were just basically looking to arrest people who maybe didn't fit the social norm, basically, is what you are saying, and just calling it under the umbrella of vagrancy.
Yes, that's exactly what they were doing, yes.
I can imagine that the evolution of who was considered a female impersonator to somebody now who fully embraces the drag culture or somebody who considers themselves trans, it's got to be sort of eye-opening for you to see how that evolution sort of changed with time.
That progression is interesting. You still see similar pushback against female impersonators as you do now with modern transgender individuals and drag queens. People are happy and fine with them, but there's also people who aren't. And so that is still a constant in history, sadly.
We'll see it in Vegas, but don't take it to my backyard.
Exactly. And then there's kind of this dichotomy that emerges with female impersonators who perform at different locations. So kind of what I saw was that female impersonators who performed at higher class venues usually got a good outlook from the public. And female impersonators who performed at lower class institutions like bars or nightclubs like the Wagon Wheel didn't get a good public reception. You can tell because they burned down their club and they were being raided and arrested and filed on trumped up charges. But you see that dichotomy emerge with higher class female impersonators who performed at better or more reputable institutions than those who didn't. And so the public is happy to view them when they're in this setting, in this higher class setting, but not whenever they're in the, you know, the wider open space of like a lower class public forum, like a nightclub. That is not okay. But if we can travel to go see this individual who's actually a star, this is entertainment, this is acting, but not whenever it's in your own backyard, whenever it's just someone who's just dressed up in drag, basically.
Jean Alvear is a recent graduate of the University of Texas at San Antonio. When we come back, Alvear tells us about a cross-dressing woman, but this story has a twist.
She had legions of female fans who loved her work, who thought she was a man fully. So she ended up having a girlfriend, basically. But the relationship took a turn whenever that girlfriend discovered she was actually
a woman.
Yes.
That's next on Fronteras. Welcome back to Fronteras. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. Cities like San Antonio, El Paso, Austin, and Dallas have passed non-discrimination ordinances for persons based on sexual orientation and gender identity. But no state law exists in Texas that specifically bans discrimination against LGBTQ persons. The queer population of Texas still has an uphill climb when it comes to civil rights. A failed bathroom bill a few years ago aimed to keep transgender individuals from using restrooms that reflected the gender with which they identified. And it's legal for child welfare organizations to deny services to same-sex couples based on religious belief. Jean Alvear is a recent graduate of the University of Texas at San Antonio. He took a deep dive into Texas queer history in the early 20th century and found a few news articles of female and male impersonators facing trumped-up charges of vagrancy. Alvear struggled to find stories about a population that tried to remain in the shadows in the deeply conservative state of Texas. The stories he did uncover opened another door to discovery.
There was a story written about a male impersonator. This is an individual who was a woman who dressed as a man to perform as a woman on stage.
Sort of like the Julie Andrews movie Victor Victoria.
So it was a very interesting story because she decided to do this because it was a male-dominated institution. And so she figured she would be able to get a better livelihood if she pretended to be a man in order to pretend to be a woman. And I just found that whole ordeal just fascinating because eventually it got out that she was a woman. She became so popular with the public, according to the article, that she had legions of female fans who loved her work, who thought she was a man fully. And so she ended up having a girlfriend, basically. But the relationship took a turn whenever that girlfriend discovered she was actually
a woman.
Yes. And so what ended up happening was her career fell through. She was ruined and destitute. And that's where the story cuts off in the article. But that is another interesting story that comes out of this history that's just out here waiting to be found. Another interesting tidbit. I found an instance that could be argued that their constitutional rights were violated. This is an instance in San Antonio, sadly, where female impersonators were arrested and detained. And while awaiting some form of prosecution, they were kept and held, but no charges were actually filed against them for some reason. And this was during the time where vagrancy was constantly being applied and sodomy laws were enforced. And I was very surprised that they didn't charge these individuals with either of those two crimes. They were just detaining them for about like a day, maybe. And so what ended up happening was no charges were filed against this group of female impersonators. But they were charged about $300 bail each. And so that goes into part of the U.S. Constitution where no excessive fines or bail should be a charge to an individual. Their constitutional rights were just violated, but no one seemed to care at this moment in time.
And because of who they were.
Yeah, because of who they were, exactly. And that's what you see constantly with my research, is that no one really cares if the rules are fully applied to them because of who they are or what they're doing. It's not something that we support. So why should the rules apply to them equally as they do to us, basically? There's another instance where a group of female impersonators were given the choice of either staying in jail or leaving a town. So they left. They left and never came back because between the choice of jail and having your freedom, I'm going to choose my freedom as well. But it's that constant recurring oppression that these individuals were facing, you know? While talking to friends and family about my work, they're just like, Gene, why are you reading this? This just sounds depressing. It kind of is, but it's significant. It's important because, yeah, it's depressing, but this is happening now still. If this was happening way back then, why is it happening now? Why didn't we not learn a lesson before? What is going on? Why is this not being taught? And why is this happening again, that to the point where, you know, someone who is an undergraduate is researching it and probably for the first time actually understanding what it means? Why has no one talked about it before?
And I think that's one of the burdens of being a historian, right? Because you can recognize history repeating itself in instances when it's not the best kind of history you want to be remembering. But then again, this is the kind of history that was kept under wraps.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's the history that is kept to the sidelines that no one really wants to acknowledge. But it has to be acknowledged, because otherwise, how else do we learn? How else do we understand each other as human beings? Like, it saddens me, but it's also so inspiring, because still, even as they were being discriminated against so heavily by society and by the state and by local law enforcement, they still persisted all the way up until the modern day to become drag queens and drag kings and transgender individuals, if I can apply that term to them. They still persisted. And that's kind of what I want to show. There's a little bit of a light at the end of the tunnel of my work, is that we still persist as queer, transgender, gay. We're still here, and we're still existing in a society that doesn't really fully advocate for us on the scale that we would like.
And so what's next for you now? Are you going to take that research, you know, a step forward? Are you going to continue to pursue this? Or what do you have in sight now for the future?
In sight right now for the immediate future is to get accepted into a graduate program. That's the main goal for me right now, because otherwise I'm just floating out into the abyss. But once that happens, I want to expand this research. I really do. I want to add a ethnic lens to it, because I'm Mexican-American and I'm a Mexican-American gay man. And so that is significant, because machismo is a thing in the Mexican-American community. No one really talks about, you know, this type of issue among Mexican-Americans. I want to research my work at the intersection of Mexican-American culture and religious tradition, because growing up in a Mexican-American family is great, but it's also challenging. I was in the closet for a long time with my family, and luckily, they were all very supporting of me. And so in this day and age, that's great, but it could have easily gone the other way. There's other individuals like me, especially in a place like Texas and San Antonio, where the Mexican population is pretty high. And so if I can add a little bit of information for individuals who were like me growing up in rural South Texas to a Mexican-American family who was gay and who was overly religious, then that's going to be a benefit to me and for them as a whole. I really want to provide a history that individuals can open and see and easily access and just get a sense that you're not alone and just know that you're not an oddity. We're all people who have existed throughout time.
Gene Alvear received his undergraduate degree in history from the University of Texas at San Antonio. He's a first-generation college student and is a recipient of the Andrew W. Mellon Fellowship. His scholarly article published at UTSA is entitled Recovering Queer History in Texas, Female Impersonators, Public Opinion, and Policy Responses in the Early 20th Century. We have a link to it on tpr.org. Thanks for joining us this week on Fronteras. You can find the show under the Programs tab on our website, tpr.org, and wherever you get your podcasts. Fronteras is produced by Norma Martinez and Lauren Terrazas. Our executive producer is Dan Katz. Our digital content producer is Bree Kirkham. Our editor is Fernando Ortiz Jr. Charanga Cakewalk composed our theme music. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.